Hello and welcome to the podcast. This is Ron's Amazing Stories. We have stories that should thrill you a little and chill you a little.
It's amazing.
You will hear adventures sent in by you guys, classic stories from the pulp mags, and episodes from the golden age of radio. We have special segments like Ghost Stories with Sylvia.
That's amazing.
And the paranormal with Jason.
I think we're going to have a lot of fun.
So settle in for the next hour and enjoy the show. Oh, and you just might want to prepare yourself to be taken away from today.
Another 5-minute mystery.
This 5-minute mystery is being brought to you by your stories. Ira Glass once said that great stories happen to those who can tell them. But if you don't tell them, great things can't happen. Do you have a story to tell? Why not send it in to the show today?
It is late afternoon in a small seaboard town, and in an old-fashioned house, old Doc Tucker is resting in his office, waiting for his housekeeper to bring him a cup of his beloved black coffee.
Doc Tucker, if you don't quit using that new operating table for a couch, if you knew how it scares a body to walk in here and see you stretched out there.
It's better than a couch, Carrie. It's adjustable. Long as I was foolish enough to buy this contraption, I might as well...
I'll get it, doctor.
Is there a doctor here? I saw the sign. My friend, we were humming and the gun went off.
Good heavens, bring him right in. Doctor!
I'm here, Carrie. Here, young fella. Put him right down here.
How is he, doctor?
A shotgun can make an awful mess of a man. Doesn't seem to be any buckshot in him, except right here where it almost tore a hole through his chest.
But how is he?
Well, I'm afraid there's not much we can do for you, friend, young fella. He's dead. Feel better now? Sort of keeled over. What's this all about?
My name is Johnson, Bertrand Johnson. His name is Billings. We were partners in business.
I see. I'll have to know what happened for my report.
Well, as I said, we were out hunting near here. That is, he was. Golf is my game. And today, he taught me how to aim and fire a shotgun.
This accident, if you could maybe tell me just how it happened.
Well, as I told you, he'd been showing me how to aim the gun, and then some birds flew out of the bushes up ahead of us. He told me to go after them.
You only had this one gun between you?
Yes, Billings owned it.
So you went after the birds?
Every time I got near them, they flew away. I kept following them. I guess I must have lost track of direction. I saw something move in a bush and shot at it. It was Billings.
How could you make a mistake like that?
I don't know. But the bush was very thick and it was so far away.
Far away?
Well, it must have been at least 50 yards.
Excuse me. Carrie, can you come in here a minute?
Yes, doctor.
Here, Carrie, I want you to make a phone call. Number is on this slip of paper.
I'll leave my name and address, doctor, and the name of my partner's wife. If you could telephone her before I attempt to break the news.
It won't be necessary. Your name and address, I mean.
I don't understand.
That was the sheriff I asked Carrie to get on the phone. Until he gets here, I'm holding you for murder.
What makes the doctor suspect that what appears to be a typical hunting accident is deliberate murder? Do you know the clue? We'll learn in a moment, but first...
Well, my first thought is how the doctor was going to hold him for murder. I mean, using his voice alone, he doesn't sound like he could hold anybody. Secondly, why in the world would the guy have brought the body in? I mean, if he meant to murder him. That seems like a pretty foolish thing to do. Of course, we've never said that these mysteries have to make sense. Just tell us a story. After all, isn't that why we're all here? I think it is.
Now, back to our story.
Doctor, you've no right to accuse me like this.
A little while ago, young fella, you were asking me how bad your friend was hurt, as if you didn't know. Then you told me Billings was behind a bush about 50 yards away when this accident happened. Anybody who knows about shotguns knows that the farther away the target is, the more the pattern of buckshot spreads out. The pattern of buckshot in Billings' body proves that it was no accident, that you couldn't have been more than a few feet from him when you pulled the trigger. No, my friend, your alibi missed its mark.
Well, that explanation makes perfect sense. I've shot a shotgun or two myself, and unless it's loaded with a slug, that shot is gonna spread. So, this one makes sense. This 5-Minute Mystery was brought to you by your stories. Why not send one in today?
Yes, that you said.
Welcome to the podcast. Today, we have stories.
Ron, isn't that what we do here?
Yes, but today is special because we have a lot of stories.
Okay, again, this is not new.
Well, what if I were to tell you that we have a screaming shadow?
Intriguing.
I thought you might think so. Also, we have a brand new Johnny Is It True and a tale that is a real mind-bender entitled An Adventure in the Fourth Dimension.
What scientific principle explains the mind-bending?
You'll just have to listen and find out.
You keep dodging the question.
I know. We end the show with a listener request that is one of my favorite short stories that we've ever had on the show.
That's a lot of different stories.
It is. We've seen a slowdown in the story submissions of late. I'm guessing with all that has happened these past few weeks, people haven't had time or possibly even power to send them in. So if you've been holding off, now is a good time to do it. Please contact me using the email or the main website and start sending your stories in once again. Also, a quick reminder that I'm preparing for the 500th episode and I'm looking for stories about time slips or time loss. So if you have one of those, please get it to me. Thank you. Now let's get to the rest of our show with this from Audible. Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/Ron's Amazing Stories. They have over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, computer, Kindle. Whatever you have, you can listen to Audible on it. So what am I listening to right now? The Wonderful Wizard of Oz by L. Frank Baum. We all know the movie, but do you really know one of the best-known stories in American culture? The Wonderful Wizard of Oz has stirred the imagination of young and old alike for over 100 years. Follow the adventures of young Dorothy Gale and her dog Toto as they get swept away into the magical land of Oz on an unforgettable journey to the Emerald City. Academy Award-winning actress Anne Hathaway, from movies like Rachel Getting Married, Alice in Wonderland, The Dark Knight Rises, and many more, lends her voice to this uniquely American fairy tale. She does an outstanding job reading this for us, and here is a clip to prove it.
"We cannot be far from the road of yellow brick now,"
remarked the Scarecrow as he stood beside the girl,
"for we have come nearly as far as the river carried us away."
The Tin Woodman was about to reply when he heard a low growl, and turning his head, which worked beautifully on hinges, he saw a strange beast come bounding over the grass towards them. It was, indeed, a great yellow wildcat, and the woodman thought it must be chasing something, for its ears were lying close to its head and its mouth was wide open, showing two rows of ugly teeth, while its red eyes glowed like balls of fire. As it came nearer, the Tin Woodman saw that running before the beast was a little gray field mouse, and although he had no heart, he knew it was wrong for the wildcat to try to kill such a pretty, harmless creature. So, the woodman raised his axe, and as the wildcat ran by, he gave it a quick blow that cut the beast's head clean off from its body, and it rolled over at his feet in two pieces. The field mouse, now that it was freed from its enemy, stopped short, and coming slowly up to the woodman, it said in a squeaky little voice,
"Oh, thank you! Thank you ever so much for saving my life!"
"Don't speak of it, I beg of you," replied the woodman. "I have no heart, you know, so I am careful to help all those who may need a friend, even if it happens to be only a mouse."
"Only a mouse?"
cried the little animal indignantly.
"Why, I am a queen, the queen of all the field mice."
"Oh, indeed," said the woodman, making a bow.
"Therefore, you have done a great deed, as well as a brave one in saving my life," added the queen.
At that moment, several mice were seen running up as fast as their little legs could carry them, and when they saw their queen, they exclaimed,
"Oh, Your Majesty, we thought you would be killed! How did you manage to escape the great wildcat?"
And they all bowed so low to the little queen that they almost stood upon their heads.
"This funny tin man," she answered, "killed the wildcat and saved my life. So hereafter, you must all serve him and obey his slightest wish." "We will!"
cried all the mice in a shrill chorus, and then they scampered in all directions, for Toto had awakened from his sleep, and seeing all these mice around him, he gave one bark of delight and jumped right into the middle of the group. Toto had always loved to chase mice when he lived in Kansas, and he saw no harm in it. But the Tin Woodman caught the dog in his arms and held him tight, while he called to the mice, "Come back, come back, Toto shall not hurt you." At this, the queen of the mice stuck her head out from a clump of grass and asked in a timid voice,
"Are you sure he will not bite us?"
"I will not let him," said the woodman, "so do not be afraid." One by one, the mice came creeping back, and Toto did not bark again, although he tried to get out of the woodman's arms and would have bitten him had he not known very well he was made of tin. Finally, one of the biggest mice spoke.
"Is there anything we can do," it asked, "to repay you for saving the life of our queen?"
"Nothing that I know of," answered the woodman. But the scarecrow, who had been trying to think but could not because his head was stuffed with straw, said quickly,
"Oh, yes! You can save our friend, the cowardly lion, who is asleep in the poppy bed."
"A lion?"
cried the little queen.
"Why, he would eat us all up."
"Oh, no," declared the scarecrow. "This lion is a coward."
"Really?"
asked the mouse.
"He says so himself," answered the scarecrow, "and he would never hurt anyone who was our friend. If you will help us to save him, I promise that he shall treat you all with kindness."
"Very well," said the queen. "We will trust you. But what shall we do?"
"Are there many of these mice which call you queen and are willing to obey you?"
"Oh, yes, there are thousands," she replied.
"Then send for them all to come here as soon as possible, and let each one bring a long piece of string."
The Wonderful Wizard of Oz is such a wonderful book, and you can have it today. Here is what Audible has set up for us. They are offering a free audiobook and 30 days to give you the opportunity to check out their service. This includes free access to the Audible Plus catalog, which is updated monthly with brand new titles. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/Ron's Amazing Stories. Again, that's audibletrial.com/Ron's Amazing Stories, and you can listen to The Wonderful Wizard of Oz by L. Frank Baum. Thank you, Audible. And now, it's time for your stories.
These are your stories, sent by you, for you.
The This story comes from Antonia Banks and is one of the most terrifying we've ever had on Ron's Amazing Stories. It sent chills down my spine as I read it for the first time, and I'm sure it's going to send chills down my spine as I attempt to read it to you now. Let's get to it. Hello, Ron. I've wanted to write in for a while now, but I never could find the time. I live in Ashland, Texas, and I know of your fondness for stories from our state. I've got one for you, and as you like to say, it may chill you a little. I love all things spooky and strange. Must be why I like your amazing stories. This happened to me a few years ago, and I'm not sure about the date. It is a story that I like to call Night Screams. I was driving home from a friend's wedding on the good old 259 heading out from Longview Heights. After you get out of Cargill, things get pretty lonely on the road. There's not much to see and no real stops except for a few rest areas and isolated communities. I decided to pull off at one of those rest areas and take a break. It was about 11:30 p.m. I had packed a lunch and was relaxing when I heard the first scream. It was terrifying. It didn't sound human, and it certainly was not in distress. The only way I can describe it is menacing, like it was attacking its prey. I looked around the area, and I didn't see anything. This was your typical rest area. Parking spots, a few picnic tables, a restroom, and a convenience center. On the east side was the truck parking area. I was alone, but there was an 18-wheeler parked to the east. I was just about to say to myself that I must be hearing things when it came again. This time closer, and if it was possible, sounded even angrier. I locked the doors to my car and started looking around again. That's when I saw it. It was a shadow thing coming from around the west side of the restroom. It stopped short and then looked at me. It had no eyes that I could see, no real shape for that matter, but there it was. I thought that this would be a good time to get out of there. I reached for my keys only to find them gone. Then I remembered that I used them to get the lunch from my trunk. I must have left them in the lock. The thing had not moved and was still staring at me. I felt cold, alone, and vulnerable. A third scream, and then the beast, or whatever it was, ran towards my car. I'm not sure why, but I braced for impact, and it came. The thing landed on the hood of my car, and then it growled. Then I heard another sound. The 18-wheeler's horns was blasting. The thing turned what I thought must be its head and bounded away into the night. I took a deep breath and looked around outside the car. It was gone, but it wasn't done. I heard one more scream, which faded away into the night. I didn't wait around, and neither did the 18-wheeler. I got out, grabbed my keys, and we both headed back out onto the old 259. I didn't stop until I got back home. The next morning, I went out to look at my car. There was a good-sized dent in the hood, which I had a really hard time explaining to the insurance company. I checked on the internet and have yet to find a story like mine. Ron, have you ever heard of anything like it before? Antonia Banks, Ashland, Texas. Well, Antonia, I can honestly say that you did send a chill and a thrill down my spine. Oh, and no, I have never heard a story like that one before. I did do some research, and I did find a story from San Antonio. It comes from the San Antonio Current, dated September 14th, 2012, and was posted by Chasing Shadows. A local woman named Stacy Algios related an extremely creepy and disturbing tale to me. According to Stacy, when she was a very young girl living on the far west side of San Antonio, She was awoken one night by an uncomfortable sensation and felt eerily compelled to look out of her bedroom window. As her eyes adjusted to the darkness, Stacy could clearly make out the outline of a humanoid figure standing behind the white picket fence that surrounded her yard. Although she could not make out much in the way of features, she could clearly discern what she interpreted to be a pork pie hat on top of the figure's head. As Stacy fearfully watched, the being began to sidle in a strange sideways motion, all the while keeping its outstretched arms on top of the fence post. When she noticed the audible crunching of dried leaves beneath the entity's feet, she was quite sure that she was not dreaming nor imagining things. Understandably terrified, the young girl dove beneath her sheets, quaking in fear until morning. As she laid underneath those blankets, the thing let out a scream that filled the night. Well, not exactly your story, but also just as freaky. Thank you for your story, Antonia. It will truly go down as one of our most amazing stories. Well, those are your stories for this time. If you have a story that you would like to share, like Antonia did, head to the main website at ronsamazingstories.com and click on the story submission banner. Please remember to leave your name, title your story, and tell me where you're from. Make your stories our stories.
Johnny, is this true?
As you know by now, I like to surf the internet to find the strange and unusual. I do this in the name of the podcast, but the truth is, I would do it anyway, even if there was no podcast. What you're about to hear is...
Johnny, is this true?
I will tell you a story and then ask the question, did I make it up or is it true? Your job is to decide. Let's get started.
Johnny, is this true?
Here we are with another round of the strange but possibly true stories. Can you pick the fake from the real? This time our stories come from the pages of the New York Post. Or did they? Let's get started. Story 1. Two Florida women dressed up as grannies in an attempt to get vaccinated against COVID-19. The strange thing was is that they were coming back to get their second dose. Now I know that we all want this thing to be over, but would folks go this far to make it happen? In fact, they did. Their wacky getup included bonnets, gloves, and glasses, the whole thing, said Dr. Raul Pino, the director of the Florida Department of Health in Orange County. Workers noticed that the woman looked funny and stopped them before they could get their shots. The duo was coming in for their second dose of the vaccine. Pino said he didn't know how they were able to get their first shot, and it's unclear if they used the same ruse. The women were 44 and 34 years old. Crazy. Story 2. This next story has to be fake. A Boston man hijacked a van loaded with $10,000 worth of lobster bound for Europe. He didn't get very far because he got into an accident with another truck carrying, wait for it, a load of lobsters. Now, is this story a load of shellfish? Well, this is a true story. Employees at Buy New England Lobsters in Charleston were loading the truck about 12:30 a.m. when a 29-year-old man jumped into the cabin and sped off. Instead of floundering, the workers gave chase in a second lobster truck and caught up with the man several blocks away. The brazen shellfish thief then deliberately slammed his stolen vehicle into the second truck. The quick-thinking employees risked getting clawed and detained the man until police arrived. "It's probably the most Boston thing that's ever happened," said Officer Peter Legaro. Story 3. Our next story comes from the weird city of Portland, Oregon. Yep, right here in my own backyard. A man was walking on the interstate bridge when he was attacked by a coyote. That in itself is not the strange part. There are a lot of those little beasties running around here. What made this perplexing was that the canine was wearing a red hoodie which read, "On my way to Grandma's." By all that's good and holy, this has to be a fake. Right? Well, if you said this one was hogwash, you would be right. I totally made this up, and in fact, I had fun doing it. Story 4. Our last story is hard to believe, but it's true. Or is it? An Arizona man's emotional support animal is creating quite the buzz. David Keller successfully registered a swarm of bees as his service pet, and it worked. Now, when traveling, he can legally take his bees with him wherever he goeth. Now, this can't be possibly true, can it? Well, a lot of people thought it was hilarious, and a lot of people were upset, but this one is true. Keller recently went to a website, successfully uploaded a random photo of a beehive as a service animal to bring awareness to the issue that anyone could do this. Many other species are also given the title, including a squirrel, a peacock, monkey, and believe it or not, an alligator. How about that? Well, that's it for this time. I hope you enjoyed these strange but true stories on Johnny, Is It True? Do you have any unusual or strange stories that you want to share? Send them to Ron's Amazing Stories, and I'll use them, if I can. Our featured story for this week is a real mind-bender. It's not so much the story itself, but how it is told. It comes from Weird Tales magazine, October of 1923. Keep that date in mind while you listen to this story. Also keep in mind that Einstein was 44 years old and had already taken the world by storm with his thoughts on the relativity of time. The story is titled An Adventure in the Fourth Dimension and just might be the most sophisticated science fiction story we've ever had. It is read for us by Dale Grothman.
The thought of meteors terrifies me. They have a disagreeable habit of coming down and killing people at the most inopportune times. That is why I was so startled when I saw a large object hurtling toward me out of the sky, as I was walking along the lakefront recently in my city of Chicago. I shivered. This was the end. I began to say my prayers. To my astonishment, the onrushing missile struck the grass beside me without the slightest jar. I gasped. Thousands of singular objects began to detach themselves. They bounded from the mass and suddenly increased in size from 1 inch to 3 feet in diameter. They were entirely round and covered with teeth. On each tooth were 10 ears, constantly in motion. Each ear carried a quizzical eye. The dwarfish creatures rolled rapidly on the ground, the ears serving as legs, hands, tentacles, and whatnot, propelling them with incredible speed. Sometimes they stood on only four or five of their ears, then suddenly pressed hard against the ground with a half a thousand ears at once, thus bounding high into the air. They lit without jar, for the ears acted as shock absorbers and broke their fall. Surely these are explorers from Mars or Venus, I thought, as the funny bounding creatures filled the air. You are wrong. They are Jupiterian, said a voice behind me. I recognized the voice. It was Professor Nutt. You probably know him. Ahem, he said. Ahem, ahem. And once more he repeated, ahem. Interesting if true, I remarked. And what might Jupiterians be? They might be men, but they're not, he snapped. They are people from the planet Jupiter. Out of your ignorance, you thought they were Martians or Venusians. But you are wrong, for Mars and Venus have people of three dimensions, like ourselves. Jupiterians are entirely different. There are 600,000 of them in this Jupiterian airship. I was so overjoyed at finding someone who could tell me about them that I didn't think to ask him how he knew all these startling facts. Where is the airship you speak of? I asked. There it is, he answered rather grandiloquently, and pointed to the empty spot on the grass. I looked carefully and made out a vast transparent globe, apparently of glass, which was rapidly becoming visible because of the Chicago dust that was settling upon it. I approached and touched it with my hand. It gave forth a metallic ring. Ah, laughed the professor, you thought it was glass, but it is made of Jupiterian steel. Look out! I sprang back at his warning, and the last 100,000 leapt out of the globe, passing right through the transparent metal of which it was composed. Nom de mademoiselle, I exclaimed in astonishment. This is a swear word I had learned in France when I was in the army. Nom de mademoiselle, I repeated, for I like to show off my knowledge of language. How can they pass through the glass without breaking it? Through the Jupiterian steel, you mean, said Professor Nutt severely. I told you before that it is not glass. Jupiterian steel has four dimensions, and they pass through the fourth dimension. That's why you can't see the metal, for your eyes are only three-dimensional. Are the Jupiterian people four-dimensional? I said, awed. Certainly, said Nutt, rather irritably. Then how can I see them? I exclaimed triumphantly. You see only three of their four dimensions, he replied. The other one is inside. I turned to look again at the Jupiterians, who now covered the whole waterfront. One of them sprang lightly 50 feet into the air, extended 100 ears like tentacles, and seized an English sparrow. He crushed the sparrow with some score or more of his teeth, which, as I have said, covered his whole body. In less than a minute, the poor bird was chewed to pieces. I looked closer and saw that the Jupiterian had no mouth. Nom de mademoiselle, I exclaimed for the third time. How can it get the bird into its stomach? Through the fourth dimension, said Professor Nutt. It was true. The chewed-up pieces of the bird were suddenly tossed into the air, and the Jupiterian sprang lightly after them. In mid-air, he turned inside out, caught the pieces of the bird in his stomach, and lit on the grass again, right side up with care. "Did you see that?" I exclaimed in a hushed voice. "Why can't I turn inside out that way?" "Because you are not four-dimensional," replied the professor, a trace of annoyance in his voice. "It is a beautiful thing to have four dimensions," he rhapsodized. "Your Jupiterian is your only true intellectual, for he alone can truly reflect. He turns his gaze in upon himself." "And sees what he had for breakfast," I gasped, "and what his neighbors had too?" "Your questions are childish," said the professor wearily. A Jupiterian, of course, can look into the soul of things and see what his neighbors had for breakfast, as you so vulgarly expressed it. But Jupiterians turn their thoughts to higher things. The creatures now surrounded me, their ears turned inward, as if they were supplicating. "What do they want?" I asked the professor. "They want something to drink," he replied. "They are pointing their ears toward their stomachs to show that they are thirsty." "Oh," I said, and pointed toward the lake. "There is the fresh, cool water of the lake, if they're thirsty." "Don't be fantastic," said Professor Nutt. "It isn't water they want." He turned his stern, pitiless gaze on my hip pocket. I turned pale, for it was my last pint. But I had to submit. If you have ever had Professor Nutt's cold, accusing eyes on you, you will know just how I felt. I drew the flask from my pocket and handed it to the chief Jupiterian, who waggled his ears in joy. Immediately there was pandemonium, if you know what I mean. 10,000 times 10,000 ears seized the cork and pulled it out in a resounding pop. One thirsty Jupiterian passed right through the glass into the bottle in his eagerness to get at the contents, and nearly drowned for his pains. "You see how useful it is to be four-dimensional," remarked the professor. "You could get into any cellar in the world merely by passing through the walls, and into any beer keg in the same way." "But," I argued, "how did this insect get through the glass into the whiskey bottle? The glass is only three-dimensional, like everything else in this world." "Don't call him an insect," Nutt sharply reprimanded me. "He is a Jupiterian, and as such, he is infinitely superior to you and me. He passed through the glass because he is four-dimensional, even though the glass isn't. If you had four dimensions, you could untie any knot by merely passing it through itself. You could turn inside out, or pass through yourself until your right hand became your left hand, and change into your own image as you flee it in the looking-glass." "Nom de Mademoiselle!" I exclaimed for the fourth time. A distant noise of barking was borne to my ears by the breeze. All the dogs in the city seemed to have gone wild. "They are disturbed by the talking of Jupiterians," explained the professor. "It is too high-pitched for clodhopper human ears to hear, unless they have unusual range, but the dogs can hear it plainly." I listened, and finally made out a very shrill humming, higher than any sound I had ever heard before in my life, and infinitely sweet and piercing. "Ah, I am hearing four-dimensional sounds," I thought, aloud. "Wrong, as usual," exacerbated the professor, with much heat. "Sound has no dimensions. It proceeds in waves and bends back upon itself until it meets itself at an infinite distance from the starting point. There are three reasons you can't hear the music of the spheres. First, because it is bent away from the earth by the force of gravity as it passes the sun. Second, because your ears are not attuned to so shrill a sound. And third, because there is no music of the spheres. The first two reasons are really unnecessary in the light of the third, but a scientific mind such as mine is not content with one reason when three can be adduced just as easily." "Shades of Sir Oliver Lodge," I ejaculated. "Sir Oliver is alive," the professor corrected me. "A man does not become a shade until after his death. Then he becomes a four-dimensional creature, like the Jupiterians, only different." "Nom de Mademoiselle," I commented. "Say something sensible," he reprimanded me. "For the love of Einstein, how do you know all these things about the Jupiterians?" I asked, a sudden suspicion flashing across what I am pleased to call my mind. "Ah, Einstein, yes," exclaimed Nutt, greatly pleased. "My mother's father's name was Einstein." "Then you are related to—" "No, I am not related," he interrupted, but my mother's father is. A sort of fourth-dimensional relationship, I suppose, I replied sarcastically. At that moment, the air became vibrant with an invisible sound. The Jupiterians came rolling from all directions, as if they had suddenly heard the dinner bell. They bounded through the Jupiterian steel of the globe and immediately shrank in size from 3 feet to 1 inch. The Jupiterian assembly call just blew, explained the professor. Notice how the passengers draw into themselves. 600,000 are now packed into that globe. Our elevated railroads miss a great opportunity by not having four-dimensional creatures to deal with. They pack us in just as tight, I ventured to remark. The globe had begun to shoot into the air when there came from behind me a high-pitched wail of distress. A shriller and higher sound than had ever before been heard by human ears, so the professor assured me. The chief Jupiterian had been left behind. He, it was, who had passed into the whiskey bottle. Not content with getting the lion's share of the contents, he had surrounded the bottle, in his pleasant four-dimensional way, and now he could not get rid of it. "Why doesn't he turn inside out and drop the bottle?" I asked, watching the Jupiterian with interest. "Because your whiskey has paralyzed him," answered the professor. "He is quite helpless." I looked at the globe, which had alighted again. Each Jupiterian suddenly resumed his full size in a brave attempt to bound to the assistance of his chief. But the creatures could no longer pass through the four-dimensional metal of which the globe was composed. So thick a layer of Chicago dust had settled upon it that to all intents and purposes it had become three-dimensional. The sudden impact of 600,000 bodies caused it to burst, with a roar as of 100 peals of thunder exploding simultaneously. The air was filled with dead and dying Jupiterians. A dark cloud settled over the landscape, composed by the flying dust shaken from the Jupiterian globe by the explosion. Long streamers of electric fire shot from the fragments of the airship, and seemed to curve in upon themselves. Everything ran in curves. The darkness, the cloud, the sounds, the shaft of light, as if bent by the force of gravity. I put up my hands and fought the cloud that was settling down upon me. I seemed to be covered with falling feathers. When the cloud began to lift, I found myself in my own parlor. The air was full of flying leaves, which I was madly tearing from the book and throwing toward the ceiling. The book was a treatise on Einstein's theory of space, which I had borrowed from a friend that afternoon. I had read nearly a page in it before I fell asleep. Only 12 men in the world understand the Einstein theory, it is said. If I had read the book, I would have been the 13th, and that would have been unlucky. So it is just as well that it is destroyed. But what excuse am I going to give my friend for tearing up his book?
Did you hang on for that one? The creature elements and story were enough for me to enjoy it. Also, the idea of a Jupiterian enjoying a bottle of whiskey, well, that was quite amusing. But I do realize that the story was a bit different, and I hope you liked it as well. The story first appeared in Weird Tales magazine in 1923. This was an American fantasy and horror fiction pulp mag founded by J.C. Heinenberger in 1922. The first issue appeared in March of 1923 in newsstands. It printed early works by H.P. Lovecraft, Seabury Quinn, and Clark Ashton Smith, all of who would go on to become popular writers. However, within the year, the magazine was in financial trouble. Heinberger decided to sell his interest to Rural Publishing Corporation, and despite occasional financial setbacks, it prospered over the next 15 years. Under the new management, the magazine lived up to its subtitle, which was The Unique Magazine. and published a wide range of unusual fiction to which our story lives up to. Are you ready for another story? This one is being brought to us by Laddie's Goodies. Good treats for your dog to eat. They use all natural products with no sugar, preservatives, salts, or harmful ingredients. So check out their online store at gladdysgoodies.com. That is gladdysgoodies.com. And don't forget to use our very own promo code, RONS, to get a 20% discount on all of your purchases. That is RONS. Thank you, Gladdy.
As read by Amazing Stories, read by amazing people.
This time on As Read By, we have one of my favorite stories from the science fiction pulp magazines. This one comes to us today by request from Alex Greer from New York. He said that this was one of his favorites as well, and he wanted to hear it again. Who am I to argue? Here is, We Didn't Do Anything Wrong, Hardly, and it is read for us by Craig Franklin.
We didn't do anything wrong, hardly. I mean, it isn't like we swiped anything. We maybe borrowed a couple of things, like, but gee, we put everything back like we found it pretty near. Even like the compressor we got from Stinky Brinker that his old man wasn't using, and I traded my outboard motor for, my father made me trade back. But it was like Skinny said, you know, Skinny Thompson. He's the one you guys keep calling the boy genius, but shucks, he's no... Well, yeah, it's like Skinny said. We didn't need an outboard motor, and we did need a compressor. You've got to have a compressor on a spaceship. Everybody knows that. And that old compression chamber that old man, Mr. Fields, let us use, didn't have a compressor. Sure, he said we could use it. Anyway... He said we could play with it, and Skinny said we were going to make a spaceship out of it, and he said, go ahead. Well, no, he didn't say it exactly like that. I mean, well, like he didn't take it serious, sort of. Anyway, it made a swell spaceship. It had 4 portholes on it, and an airlock, and real bunks in it, and lots of room for all that stuff that Skinny put in there. But it didn't have a compressor, and that's why... What stuff? Oh, you know, the stuff that Skinny put in there, like the radars he made out of a TV set, and the anti-gravity and the atomic power plant he invented to run it all with. He's awfully smart, Skinny is. But he's not like what you'd think of a genius. You know, he's not all the time using big words, and he doesn't look like a genius. I mean, we call him Skinny because he used to be Skinny. But he isn't now. I mean, he's maybe small for his age. Anyway, smaller than me, and I'm the same age as he is. Of course, I'm big for my age, so that doesn't mean much, does it? Well, I guess Stinker Brinker started it. He's always riding Skinny about one thing or another, but Skinny never gets mad. And it's a good thing for Stinker, too. I saw Skinny clean up a bunch of ninth graders. Well, a couple of them anyway. They were saying... Well, I guess I won't tell you what they were saying. Anyway, Skinny used judo. I guess, because that wasn't much of a fight. Anyway... Stinker said something about how he was going to be a rocket pilot when he grew up, and I told him that Skinny had told me that there wouldn't be any rockets, and that anti-gravity would be the thing as soon as it was invented, so Stinker said it never would be invented, and I said it would so, and he said it would not, and I said... Well, if you're going to keep interrupting me, how can I... All right, anyway, Skinny broke into the argument and said that he could prove mathematically that anti-gravity was possible, and Stinker said, sure... He could, and Skinny said, sure he could, and Stinky said, sure he could, like that. Honestly, is that any way to argue? I mean, it sounds like two people agreeing, only Stinky keeps going, sure, like that, you know. And Stinky, what does he know about mathematics? He's had to take remedial arithmetic ever since... No, I don't understand how the anti-gravity works, Skinny told me. But it was something about meson flow and stuff like that, and I didn't understand. The atomic power plant made more sense. Where did we get the uranium? Gee, no, we couldn't afford uranium, so Skinny invented a hydrogen fusion plant. Anyone can make hydrogen. You just take zinc and sulfuric acid and deuterium. You mean like heavy hydrogen? No, Skinny said it would probably work better, but like I said, we couldn't afford anything fancy. As it was, Skinny had to pay $5 or $6 for that special square tubing in the anti-gravity and the plastic space helmets. We had cost us 98 cents each. And it cost $1.50 for the special tube that Skinny needed to make a TV set into a radar. You see, we didn't steal anything, really. It was mostly stuff that was just lying around, like the TV set was up in my attic, and the old refrigerator that Skinny used the parts to make the atomic power plant out of from. And then a lot of the stuff we already had, like the skin diving suits we'd made into spacesuits, and the vacuum pump that Skinny had already, and the generator. Sure, we did a lot of skin diving, but that was last summer. That's how we knew about old man Brinker's compressor that Stinky said was his, and I traded my outboard motor for, and had to trade back. And that's how we knew about Mr. Field's old compression chamber and all that. The rocket? Well, it worked on the same principle as the atomic power plant, and it doesn't work except in a vacuum, hardly. Of course, you don't need much of a rocket when you have anti-gravity. Everyone knows that. Well, anyway, that's how we built the spaceship. And believe me, it wasn't easy. I mean, with Stinky all the time bothering us and laughing at us. And I had to do a lot of lawn mowing to get money for the square tubing for the anti-gravity, the special tube for the radar, and my space helmet. Stinky called the space helmets kid stuff. He was always saying things like, "Say hello to the folks on Mars for me, and bring back a bottle of canal number 5, and all like that, you know." Of course, they did look like kid stuff, I guess. We bought them at the 5 and dime, and they were meant for kids. Of course, when Skinny got through with them, they worked fine. We tested them in the airlock of the compression chamber when we got the compressor in. They tested out pretty good for half an hour. Then we tried them on in there. Well, it wasn't a complete vacuum, just 27 inches of mercury, but that was okay for a test. So anyway, we got ready to take off. Stinky was there to watch, of course. He was saying things like, "Farewell, oh brave pioneers," and stuff like that. I mean, it was enough to make you sick. He was standing there, laughing and singing something like, "Up in the air, Junior Birdman." But when we closed the airlock door, we couldn't hear him. Skinny started up the atomic power plant, and we could see Stinky laughing fit to kill. It takes a couple of minutes for it to warm up, you know. So Stinky started throwing rock to attract our attention, and Skinny was scared that he'd crack a porthole or something, so he threw the switch, and we took off. Boy, you should have seen Stinky's face. I mean, you really should have seen it. One minute he was laughing, you know, and next minute he looked like a goldfish. I guess he always did look like a goldfish, but I mean, even more like then. And he was getting smaller and smaller because we had taken off. We were gone pretty near 6 hours, and it's a good thing my mum made me to take a lunch. Sure, I told her where we were going. Well, anyway, I told her we were maybe going to fly around the world in Skinny and my spaceship, or maybe go down to Carson's Pond. And she made me take a lunch, and made me promise I wouldn't go swimming alone. And I sure didn't. But we did go around the world 3 or 4 times. I lost count. Anyway, that's when we saw the satellite on radar. So Skinny pulled the spaceship over to it, and we got out and looked at it. The spacesuits worked fine too. Gosh, no, we didn't steal it or anything. Like Skinny said, it was just a menace to navigation, and the batteries were dead, and it wasn't working right anyway. So we tied it onto the spaceship and took it home. No, we had to tie it on top. It was too big to take inside with the antenna sticking out. Of course, we found out how to fold them later. Well, anyway, the next day, the Russians started squawking about a capitalist plot, and someone had to swipe their satellite. Gee, I mean, with all the satellites up there, who'd missed just one? So I got worried that they'd found out that we took it. Of course, I didn't need to worry, because Stinky told them all right, just like a tattletale. So anyway, after Skinny got the batteries recharged, we put it back. When we landed, there were hundreds of people standing there. And Mr. Anderson from the State Department, I guess you know the rest. Except Mr. Anderson started laughing when we told him, and he said it was the best joke on the Russians he had ever heard. I guess it's when you think about it, I mean, the Russians complaining about somebody swiping their satellite, and then the State Department answering a couple of kids borrowed it, but they put it back. One thing that bothers me, though, we didn't put it back exactly the way we found it. But I guess it doesn't matter. You see, when we put it back, we goofed a little. I mean, we put it back in the same orbit, more or less, but we got it going in the wrong direction.
That is a fun one. It first appeared in Astounding Science Fiction in May of 1959. It was written by Roger Kuykendall, and it has such a good feel to it that it's hard not to enjoy it. Also, I still think that this was the inspiration for the 1985 film Explorers. Welcome back to Old Time Radio Commercials. This time we clean things up with two famous products that we all know and love. This first one came from 1958, and the quality of the sound is astounding. I doubt Mr. Clean needs any more introduction.
Mr. Clean gets rid of dirt and grime and grease in just a minute.
Mr. Clean will clean your whole house and everything that's in it.
Floors, doors, walls, halls, white sidewall tires, and old golf balls.
Sinks, stoves, bathtubs, he'll do. He'll even help clean laundry, too.
Mr. Clean gets rid of dirt and grime and grease in just a minute.
Mr. Clean will clean your whole house and everything that's in it.
Can he clean a kitchen sink?
Quicker than a wink.
Can he clean a window sash?
Faster than a flash.
Can he clean a dirty mirror?
He'll make it bright and clearer.
Can he clean a diamond ring?
Mr. Clean cleans anything.
Mr. Clean gets rid of dirt and grime and grease in just a minute. Mr. Clean will clean your whole house and everything that's in it. Mr. Clean, Mr. Clean, Mr. Clean.
Our second one is just as famous as Mr. Clean. When Ajax was introduced in 1947, the slogan for the original scrubbing powder was Stronger Than Dirt.
Use Ajax, bum, bum, the foaming cleanser. Bum, 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 bum. Clean pots and pans, just like a whiz.
Ajax cuts grease faster than any other leading cleanser.
Use the pain, the elbow tax, when you start cleaning with Ajax.
Ajax really polishes as it cleans.
So use Ajax, bum, bum, the foaming cleanser. Bum, 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 bum. Bump the dirt right down the drain.
My gosh, they're right. Foaming action Ajax makes even the dirtiest pan shine like new in a jiffy.
So use Ajax.
That's all I have for this time. If you have any favorites or recordings of old-time commercials, let me know. Episode number 480, and I think we did good. My thanks to Antonia Banks, Dale Grothman, and Craig Franklin for your support today. It was so amazing. If you want to follow the podcast or the blog, head to ronsamazingstories.com. There you will find any of the links I mentioned and how to contact us. Do you want to help the show? The best thing you can do is to tell your friends all about it, and please leave reviews or feedback wherever you listen. Clicking that follow or like button makes us grow. Thank you for listening, and I hope you come again to find out what are Ron's Amazing Stories.